Welcome to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's live streaming interview series, where leading New Thought teachers, speakers, and authors share the intimate stories behind the 10 best spiritual books that inspired them the most on their spiritual journey. From well-known classics to hidden gems you might never have heard of, the No BS Spiritual Book Club saves you time and money by sharing reliable recommendations from those who've walked the path before you. The No BS Spiritual Book Club, the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to inspire your own journey of self-discovery. Here's your host, founder of the No BS Spiritual Book Club, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello and welcome. Joining me this week to share the 10 best spiritual books that inspired her the most on her life journey is inspirational speaker, medium, healer, and author Ali Noel. A mother of three children, here and one in spirit, Ali's four-month-old daughter Romy died in July 2014, which, as one might imagine, challenged her belief system in the most strong way possible. Ali's book, The Truth Inside, documents how she received communication from Romy in spirit in a variety of different ways, and how this eventually helped her to process her grief and uncover her own life purpose. Despite having one foot firmly in what she calls the other, Ali believes in demystifying spiritualism and taking it out of the shadows and into public awareness to aid those who grieve and offer hope to all that death is a transition rather than the end. Ali Noel, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. Thank you for having me.
So you were a very prolific reader as a child. You devoured your parents' history books and many literary classics by the age of 13. And then you went on to eat your way through the public library. What sort of books did you like after that?
So are we going straight onto the list? Shall I start with
No. Tell us about the books when you were a child.
Oh, my goodness. Well, yes, I think I do have this recollection of being strangely attached to all of the classics. I was speaking to a good friend of mine from childhood recently, and she says that one of her memories is that everyone else was out. They were all out playing on their roller skates, and I was inside, you know, reading Thomas Hardy, which makes me sound really precocious. I wasn't, but I just loved it. I loved that immersion into another world, tellingly, particularly a world of times past. I loved the classics because I was fascinated by the Victorian era, the Edwardian era in particular, the sensibilities of people of those times. And even as a young child, I remember being fascinated by historical buildings and sort of wanting to feel what it was like to be a person living in that time. So I was very much drawn to historical fiction, a lot of the literary classics. I went on to read English literature at university, and also biographies. I very much loved, that's what I was doing in my local library at about 10 or 11. I was reading biographies, anyone from Marilyn Monroe to a lot of old Hollywood film stars. Mm-hmm. I remember just an absolute fascination with the otherness of the world at that time, really, which perhaps is telling given where my interests lay later in my life.
At what age did you find yourself gravitating towards spiritual books?
I would say, I do remember, actually. I remember very young. It must have been before I was 13, because at 13, I remember my parents, we moved house. We moved from Maidstone, where I was born, further north in the UK, to Luton in Bedfordshire. But I can remember being in that first house where I was born. And I remember my parents were very interested in spirituality, my father in particular. And I can remember him bringing home a book by the later slightly controversial medium, Doris Stokes. But I remember she wrote a book about her mediumistic experiences, which was a huge bestseller. My dad brought it home and I read it, and I must have been about 12 or 13. And I can remember this prompted lots of conversations with my parents about their own spiritual experiences. And my father had always been very open and had had several experiences which he discussed with me. And then my mother, by contrast, had always been incredibly skeptical. But then after the passing of my grandfather, who was her father-in-law, she then had a spiritual experience, which she found didn't sit with her lack of belief, should I say. And it's also uncanny because apparently her father-in-law did actually say to her, you just wait. When I go, I'm going to come back and prove to you that I'm right. And, you know, allegedly he did. So we had lots of those sorts of conversations, which I found really stimulating growing up.
Did he tell her that he had he was going to give her a special message and she would know it was him?
Well, he apparently just said, I'm just going to come back and you're going to see me and you're going to know. And in the encounter that she described to me, he didn't speak to her. It was very soon after he passed, actually. And she saw him on the landing in our house. And when I say saw, she describes it as she said she could see him as if he was standing there in the flesh. And, you know, bearing in mind that at this point, my mother did not believe in anything of that nature at all, like thought there was an explanation for all of it and it was impossible. And then she said he walked from the landing into my parents' bedroom. And then he became kind of what she was seeing became sort of transparent. And then he just disappeared from view. And also she would smell for several weeks after he passed. Whenever she and my dad were leaving the house, she said she would smell a really strong smell of, there was a sweet that was really popular at that time called Fox's Glacier Mints, which I think still exists now. My grandparents always had them in a drawer and my grandfather was always eating them. And she said she would smell this overpowering smell of Fox's Glacier Mints. Didn't say anything until about the fifth time when she sort of reluctantly mentioned to my father, like, it's really strange, I can smell mint. And he said, oh, I've been smelling that for weeks. And so little things like that sort of eventually convinced her that, okay, he's made his point. And ever since that day, she's believed it. She'll now tell anyone who'll listen that, you know, well, I never believed it. And then I did. And she's had many experiences over the years. And she's actually extremely intuitive. My mother, she just chooses not to tap into it.
I had an arrangement with my father-in-law. We used the joke. There was a particular book that we both liked. And there was something in this book that we thought was hilarious. And he said, that will be my phrase when I come back and tell you. But I've never encountered him.
Oh,
so, but there's still time. There's still time.
Exactly. There's always time.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell us about your list. You know, was it easy to compile? Is it chronological? How did you put it together?
Firstly, I have to thank you for setting me this task. It was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. I thought I had a brief moment where I thought, oh my goodness, this is overwhelming. How am I going to do this? I've read my way through so many spiritual books, probably in the past 20 years. I didn't know where to start. But in actual fact, once I picked the first one, it was unbelievably easy. I don't think I edited anything I wrote. I think I just wrote the whole thing and I was done. And it is chronological. I didn't quite realise that it was until afterwards. And then I looked back on it and I just refreshed my memory by looking through it before coming on to talk to you. And I realised that it really does map out my life in various significant spiritual stages, which, you know, maybe there are no coincidences. It's really telling to me and quite amazing, really.
Well, that first book is one that comes up quite often, and rightly so. It's Jonathan Livingston Seagull by Richard Bach, which was published in 1970. So how did it come into your life and what impact did it have on you?
Well, it came into my life courtesy of my father. So it feels like a very apt place to begin, because discussing spirituality and discussions about spirituality were quite frequent in my family growing up. My dad brought this book home. I believe somebody at work lent it to him, and I must have been very young, because it must have been during the 80s. Again, I must have been sort of 11, 12. He brought it home from work, read it. I'm sure many of your listeners will be very familiar with, as you say, it comes up a lot, a lot of familiarity with this book. It's obviously a very, very small volume. And I was kind of attracted to it because I thought, oh, it's got, you know, it's got birds on the front. It had an attractive cover for a child. And my dad didn't really say anything about it. And he just said, oh, you might find this interesting, and gave it to me to read. And it was the first, it's the first memory I have of reading anything that wasn't an out and out fiction book. So this obviously came before my my predilection for biographies in the local library. So it was really my first, it was unique. It was unlike anything I'd ever read before, which I think many adults at that time might have said too, but for me as a child, it was kind of revolutionary. I find it ironic that I live now in Brighton in the UK, where we have many, many seagulls. They're very much part of our lives here. And they're regarded, you know, as a little bit hostile by visitors to the city, but I kind of love them. I find them charming and quite feisty. So I've always been very drawn to Brighton. I always knew I would live here, even though I have no family here. I don't have any connections here. So I realized when I was refreshing my memory on this list, oh, how odd that my first book is about a seagull when I live surrounded by them and they're so much a part of the landscape of my life now. Yeah. So obviously, as people will be very aware, this book is the story of a seagull who isn't satisfied with life and discovers his own purposeful way of living by refusing to follow those around him. And for me, this book is very dear to me because it came via my father, and he very much encouraged me. As me and my sister growing up, we're 2 years apart, we're very close. But my father always encouraged me to go my own way and not to follow the crowd. That is a real thing I remember him sort of teaching me about and willing me to grow into when I was growing up. That was very strong with him. And one of my three children, my daughter, is very much like that too. I love that about her. She's very spirited and she absolutely goes her own way. She doesn't care what anyone else is doing. So I think that's a very strong character trait, and I'm very proud that my dad instilled that in me. And I do remember I did take that from this book when we spoke about it afterwards. When I read it at the time, it didn't make an enormous impact on me, probably because of my age, my lack of life experience, but reflecting on it now, and over the years I have dipped into it, gone back to it time and again, the more times I go back to it, the more I refresh my memory about it, the stronger some of the themes are. Now I very much relate to it in terms of the themes of listening to intuition. I've always very much tried to live my life by that and not to be frightened of following my intuition. I've made some quite apparently impulsive decisions in life based on a gut feeling or intuition, particularly when I was younger, which have kind of caused people around me to, what are you doing? You know, you haven't planned this, but I've trusted that intuition. And I think that's a real strength that we could probably all work on developing a little bit more in life rather than just, you know, looking to conform. So I think, yeah, at the time, it very much spoke to me about going my own way. And now I think of it as being a lesson in listening to your intuition, trusting your intuition, because I think a lot of us hear it, but then we think, nah, no, don't be silly. And we do the other thing. And overcoming fear, you know, of kind of having that, you know, being galvanized to step outside of the flock, if you like, and do what feels right to you, and trusting that if it feels right to you, it probably is right for you at that point. It's special. I relate to it, to my father very much with this book. And he always said to me, which probably very much encouraged my love of reading, actually, I always remember him saying to me, and he still says it now, you know, if you can read well and enjoy reading, you can learn anything, you can teach yourself anything, you can do anything you want, you know, because you can read it in a book. And it's simple but effective.
yeah. So book two is Diary of a Psychic, Sonia Choquette, published in 2003.
Right, yes. So this I came across at a very at a period in my life where I was very much stepping into learning about spirituality and psychic skills. I'd always had that connection, always been interested in it, rather. But I think, you know, I got caught up with, you know, university and relationships. And I also, for a time, had been in a relationship with somebody who didn't place any value at all on anything like this and kind of actively discouraged my interest in it. So at the end of that relationship, I decided to fully embrace this, and I signed myself up to the College of Psychic Studies in London, and I started to attend any course that I could get my hands on and afford to do, basically anything from crystals to you know, psychic development to healing, you know, all of it. It's all there. The college is a wonderful place. And so I can't remember whether I came across this in the college library or whether somebody recommended it, but I did eventually buy a copy. And it's an autobiography by Sonia Choquette, a medium and psychic. And it really just talks about her life and how she came to develop her own psychic abilities. But I've read lots and lots of these types of book, autobiographies written by psychics and mediums, and I find them all interesting in their way, but there is something about this one, it draws me back in. I've reread it many times, which is fairly unusual for me. I don't often reread books. I like to kind of move on to the next one, but I do find myself coming back to it a lot. And what struck me about it from the outset is its familiarity. It just feels like reading a letter from a close girlfriend. She talks about her upbringing. Her mother, I believe, would read cards for neighbours growing up. And so she would kind of be in the, I remember this about the book, sort of like hiding in the next room, listening in. I remember a story about a neighbour who had a lot of relationship issues, who kept coming to her mother. And it taught me actually that developing psychic skills is very much about helping people to find their path and to get back on their path in life. And it's not about staring into a crystal ball or kind of gaining some kind of recognition or having people being in awe of you because you've got this special gift. It's very down to earth, and it very much advocates that, you know, if you choose to develop these abilities, which we do indeed all have, if you put in the work, as she details that she does, Sonia does in her book, you can be of help to many people. But it also makes the point that it's not necessarily an easy path to choose. You know, you spend a lot of time justifying your life choices to people if you choose to be open about it. It's a very gritty book. She is very honest about the difficulties she encountered on this path and the choices that she had to make. But it's very humorous. And what I took away from it overall, which I think inspired me when I was writing my own book, which is obviously also part memoir, is the fact that even though she's writing about psychic development and the fact that she is a psychic and she is a medium, I did not come away from that book feeling that she had tried to impress her beliefs on me, the reader. And that made a huge impression on me, actually, because I'm quite averse to that. I'm very open to any beliefs. I will happily read or listen to religious or spiritual opinions and experiences, but it really turns me off when, you know, you start to have people talking about this is the truth, because I really don't think that any of us can profess to know what the actual ultimate truth is until we leave this planet. So I took that with me when I was writing, because I think it's really important. And I've always felt additionally that if you want to try to encourage people to open up to your way of thinking, hammering over the head with the fact that this is absolutely true, and there is a life after death, and spirits do exist, and my spirit guide is real, is probably not the way to do it, however much you might believe that for yourself. So, you know, communicating your own beliefs with openness, I find appealing, and I understand that other people do too. And that's what I loved particularly about this, the style of this book.
Book number three is quite different. Again, it is a book that comes up again and again and again. And I don't know anybody who's read this book who hasn't, you know, been very much impressed by it. Men's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl, published in 1946. And just a phenomenal, phenomenal book.
Isn't it? I mean, I'm struggling to try to find something to say about it that probably hasn't already been said many times on this show. So yes, I will start with when I read it. So quite peculiarly, I think, I recall reading this first just around the time that I gave birth to my first child, my eldest son. I don't know how I came across it at that time. It was quite an odd thing to be choosing to read while pregnant and and a new mother, I think, but I did. And yeah, I mean, what can you? It's hard, isn't it, to find words to do this work justice. Viktor Frankl was a psychiatrist, which in itself I find a moving fact and quite extraordinary, you know, and apt that a man who had the experiences that he had would go on to seek to understand the mind, potentially the minds of the people who had incarcerated him, and therefore the minds of humanity in general. I feel, again, it's a very small volume, but my God, it packs a punch, and it has a huge reach. I remember being profoundly moved by it, as I think everyone is when they read it, not just for its references to the Holocaust and his own experiences. I'm fascinated by Holocaust history and accounts. I have some Jewish in my family several generations back, and as far as I'm aware, thank goodness, we you know, our family were not affected by that in any way. My husband's family also have a Jewish heritage, but I've always had this deep fascination with Jewish culture and heritage, and I find the Holocaust almost unbearable to read about or watch, but I try to put myself there because I think it's really important that we understand as much as we possibly can. What I took from this book is grace. You know, for a human being to experience something of the magnitude that Frankl and so many other Jews experienced, and to somehow emerge from that experience without bitterness, without recrimination or animosity. And I feel that this is, I see this in so many accounts when you read or hear or listen to interviews with Jews who survived the Holocaust or who have, you know, or further down that line, it really strikes me how much they speak with so much eloquence and so much grace. And I think that there's a really deep lesson in that for all of us in experiencing something that shakes not only one individual to the core, but, you know, technically the whole world, but to come out of that experience and think, right, what is the learning here? That's what I derived from it later in my life after my daughter died. That's something that I recall my husband and I, we had lots of long discussions in the evenings. And the thing we kept coming back to is after we'd got through the why has this happened? It's not fair. We started asking, okay, well, what do we have to learn? Why? what is the lesson here? So that's what emerges from this book for me, among many other things. The other thing that really, really struck me is that, and it's something I often quote from this book, is that there's always choice. I find myself saying this to my kids a lot in difficult situations, obviously not comparing any of those situations to experiencing the Holocaust, but, you know, when you have a really challenging life situation, you always have a choice. You might have a choice in being able to step out of that situation or not. And if you don't, you have a choice in how you react to it, and how you react to it can send ripples towards other people And it can, you know, it can make real change. So I think there's a very powerful message about change, change in this book through the choices that we make. We can choose to always do the same thing and always react in the same way. And to, we can choose to react with anger, or we can choose to carry ourselves with grace and to ask ourselves what the learning is. Because, you know, I think love and learning are probably, you know, I think if we, if more humans focused on those two things as what we, we're here to accomplish, then maybe the world would be a slightly less destabilizing place than it feels at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. Does your husband, did he read the book? Does he feel the same about it?
Yes, I believe he has read it. And his philosophy is very much, what do I have to learn? In any difficult situation, he will ask himself what, you know, or if, you know, we were talking about this recently, actually, if we've had a difficult glitch in our marriage, or, you know, it's like, okay, well, what do we have to learn? You know, do I have to learn something from you here? Or are you learning from me? Or like, what is it? He will always want to, you know, he's a thinker. He's a real thinker. He's a thinker. I'm a doer. So that can work and not, but he thinks on many levels, and that book appeals to him very much in that way. And that he likes to really pick things apart and decipher them. He's very interested in the workings of the mind. So, but I would say the strongest thing for him with this book is the whole learning from experience.
And did you both feel that having that book with you at a time, you know, one of those impossible times in life, made it a little bit easier in some way? I mean, it's never easy, but, you know, do you ever think, how would we have come to terms with that without that book?
Yes, I think in as much as there was definitely a period of time for us in our grieving very early on where it did feel very much as if, spoken words, no spoken words were right. And many people around us recognize that. You know, the first thing many people would say is, you know, I just don't know what to say, which incidentally is, you know, in my opinion, is actually a great thing to say to somebody who's grieving. It's better to say that than, oh, I know how you feel, or time's a healer, or any of the other awful cliches that come out of people's mouths. I'm sure I've been guilty of it too in the past. But, you know, spoken words weren't enough. And so we did, and we couldn't put the TV on. Our two surviving children at that time were very young. So they would go to bed, and we were just kind of like rattling around in the evenings, in pieces, really, not knowing whether, you know, we'd done the crying. It was, you know, what's, and often we would be, you know, just kind of leafing through books and reading bits out to each other. Or at one point we were looking for inspirational quotes for Romy's funeral. And books very much for both of us. And I would say I'm definitely more of a reader than my husband. My husband loves the idea of collecting books, and he tends to sort of cherry pick bits out. He will go straight for the inspirational bits, but he finds it quite challenging to sit and get through everything, something from cover to cover, whereas I will do that. So yeah, they were very much present for us in different ways, but they also kind of kept us together at that point where, you know, the TV wasn't featuring, we weren't socializing, and, you know, the people that we were with were often struggling as much as we were, to be fair, and I can't blame them. It was a pretty impossible situation. So yeah, I'm very thankful for that book coming. You know, it originally came into my life at the birth of my first child, but then I found myself drawn back to it, you know, that sort of set 5 years later, just after Romy died. And it was a great comfort. You know, you don't want to, you can't compare tragedies in life, but it was somehow comforting to think, well, this man went through something of that magnitude, and, you know, he's emerged from it, yeah, with grace. You know, he's emerged intact, he's emerged asking himself questions and looking for the learning, and that was hugely inspiring to both of us. Yes, absolutely.
Well, book number 5 is Spirit Babies. How to Communicate with the Child You're Meant to Have, Walter McKitchen, 2005, Spirit Babies. Did you read these books before you had your children?
I did, actually. So perhaps that should have come before Viktor Frankl, I'm just realising. But I sort of, I read it and I came back to it a lot. So at this time, I was working as a reflexologist. I worked for some years in charity PR, worked in public relations for Battersea Dogs and Cats Home, and then for the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew. And then I left and retrained as a reflexologist. And I remember that I was sort of choosing an area to just sort of go into in more detail as a complementary therapist. And I remember saying to my husband, I can't decide between birth and death, which seemed like a really strange thing to be thinking about at the time. But I was drawn to working with fertility and pregnancy and birth. And I was also very much drawn towards, you know, palliative care, end of life care, and the way in which complementary therapy can help there. I chose fertility, pregnancy and birth. And because I was at this point immersed in learning about psychic development and spirituality, I came across Spirit Babies. And it sort of seemed to overlap, you know, bring together the two worlds that I was very active in at that point, which was working with women, particularly or couples who were trying to conceive a child. And I can remember in particular one of my very early clients, who was a woman who'd been with her husband for many years. They were childhood sweethearts. And they had been struggling to get pregnant. She was, you know, probably in her late 20s, early 30s. There was no sort of medical reason why she couldn't conceive. And I was reading this book as I was giving weekly treatments to her. And I came across a section in the book that describes, it's a sort of a collection of case histories, mainly. Walter McCashin was a clairvoyant medium, and he claimed to be able to see a couple or woman's potential children in their aura. So that's to say, you know, you could potentially have maybe seven children in this lifetime. That doesn't mean that all seven are going to come through, but it means that's the potential. And if you invite those souls in, there is the potential that you could parent them. He makes some very interesting points, one of which is about conscious conception, about the idea that in fact incoming souls select the individuals whom they feel would parent them the best. There's so many interesting ideas in here, but I can remember reading a section of this book, a case history of a woman who had chosen to have an abortion very young in her life, and how that had impacted her later in life when she met a partner and chose to start a family. And something kind of triggered in my mind. Now, I didn't know this information about my client at the time, but something made me go into a treatment and start to ask her about her history. And during this, she opened up to me and told me that she had, in fact, with her current partner, become pregnant very young. They'd been together since school, so maybe she was 15 or 16. She'd become pregnant and she had had a termination. And she was now in her late 20s, and she'd carried that with her all that time. And she was completely torn up about it, beating herself up. And we discussed some of these themes. And I remember I referred this book to her slightly nervously, not knowing what, you know, obviously you don't always know what somebody's spiritual understandings are, whether they have an interest in that area, or whether that would be, if they're deeply religious, it can be a little off-putting to them. But I just kind of blurted out about this book and just said, look, do you think there's a possibility that you are somehow telling your body that you don't deserve to get pregnant because you had a termination, and maybe there's a way that you can work through that and accept that that's the decision you made at that time, and you can't change that decision now? And who knows, maybe the baby that's incoming to you, you know, there's a theory in Spirit Babies that says that maybe that baby would return at a later point. So we had lots of these conversations while I gave her the treatment, and she did go on to become pregnant. She had two children not long after those conversations. So coincidence, I don't know, a combination of things, very possibly. But it was a living example for me of a book that I found fascinating, And in fact, after we had our son in 2008, I remember my husband saying to me, let's have another one. Like, so kind of immediately, we kind of joked about it. And then we did kind of half jokingly say, well, let's try this conscious conception idea. You know, if there's anyone there who's waiting to come through, you know, like, why don't we just invite them? And I have to say that there was a particular morning when I turned around and said, I know I'm pregnant. And I was. And I can't, it's a very hard thing to describe, I have to say, but it was a strange feeling. I felt like in the moment, I had felt like I had felt a presence in the room. And the following morning, I physically felt quite sort of dizzy. And I just thought, I know something is inhabiting my body. And I was pregnant with our daughter, our two eldest children at 18 months apart. So very powerful ideas. And I recommended it quite frequently to many of my fertility clients, if I thought, sensed, or discovered that they were open to that. And many of them wrote to thank me and say how much it sort of opened their minds. It's really powerful.
Well, you know, parenting is one of the most important things we do. We really must do it consciously.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I can understand why that book had an impact on you. Okay. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be back in a few moments with more from Ali Narelle's 10 Best Books, Spiritual Books List. So stay tuned.
Om Times TV.
Maya Angelou once said that there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and when I'm not hosting Om Times Media's flagship radio show, What Is Going On, and the No BS Spiritual Book Club, I help people share their untold stories. Books are my life, my joy, and my passion, and there is no greater reward than helping aspiring writers get their books out of their heads and into the hands of those who are waiting to read them. If you feel that you have a book in you, but don't know where to begin, visit sedgbeer.com, click on the Work With Me tab, and find out how my experience helping others tell their stories might be just what you've been looking for. That's sedgbeer.com, sedgbeer.com.
Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself, invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust, spheric approach. Om Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, Om Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an Om Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on Om Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive Om Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. Om Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's one in five daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back, Ali Narelle. Ali Narelle. Book number six. Now, I had to smile when I saw this book on your list because it has not appeared before. But I kind of have William Stillman, and the book is Autism and the God Connection, Redefining the Autistic Experience Through Extraordinary Accounts of Spiritual Giftedness. I met William a long time ago, not physically in the flesh, but he was a contributor to my magazine, Children of the New Earth. And I kind of had a feeling at the time that I was, he was a lot younger then, of course, that I'd kind of discovered him. He became a columnist. So yeah. When he went on to write his books, I was really pleased at how far he'd come. And William is, of course, autistic himself. He's an incredible medium, incredible psychic, and a really nice writer too.
Ah, well, obviously I did not know that, Sandy, and what an extraordinary connection. Yeah, I can't actually, no, interestingly, I was looking over this list beforehand and I can't remember how I came across this book. I really can't. But my eldest son, whose birth I was describing a while ago, he was born in 2008, is on the autistic spectrum. And I instinctively knew that, despite the fact he was my first son, my sister has two boys, so, and they're older. So I'd sort of, you know, been a very hands-on auntie for a number of years before I became a mother myself. So I kind of, you know, had a sort of a slight handle on what new motherhood was like. Nevertheless, when it's your own child, you know what you know. And I just remember having this really instinctive feeling that he was on the autistic spectrum, probably from the age of around 18 months. I just started to notice little things that seemed different to the other children that we were around at the time. And I particularly recall when he was around the age of four, my husband saying to me, actually before this, I remember because he wouldn't keep still when I was changing nappies when he was little. My husband and I both learnt languages through school and university. We really love to learn languages, and you know, between us, we're not bad at them. I'm rusty now, but I remember when I was changing my son's nappy just to try to keep him engaged and keep him sort of still while I did the deed, I was teaching him to count to 10 in different languages. Now this is when he was tiny, and I remember at around the age of two he was counting to 10 in French, German, Italian, Spanish, you know, literally teach him, and he would just do it, and you would teach him once or twice and then that was it. He just had it, and it sort of became a bit of a party trick. We kept rolling him out, saying, "Look, he can count to 10 in all these languages. He's a genius." And I remember when he got to around four, my husband said to me, "I think he can read." And I said, "Don't be ridiculous. You know, he's smart. He can count in loads of languages, but he can't read." But what he did, and what we obviously now understand, now that we're far more well-versed in autism, we understand that he at a very young age had what's known as hyperlexia. So basically I would read him his favorite stories and when he was very little, and he would memorize them very quickly, just like he memorized that counting. And he would repeat them, he would parrot them to me, and he would be word perfect every time. And he did this with a selection of stories, and some of them were quite involved. And when he got to about four, my husband said, I really think he can read. And I said, okay, well, we read with him a lot, but come on, no. And so to prove his point, my husband, who is very interested in Buddhism, he has lots of really quite lengthy, but I'm looking at a couple now, actually, these massive volumes on Buddhism. So he just got one. He said, okay, watch this. And he just randomly opened one and said to our son, like, you know, can you see any words, you know, there? And he basically read out about two sentences from this book. And this is hyperlexia, which is a facet of autism. William Stillman is, of course, autistic himself. And I probably came across him again because I was reading a lot about my son's condition. I was very keen to pursue a diagnosis from when he was quite young, even though there was some resistance from different people in our lives. And my justification for that was always because I wanted to, if there was a condition there, as his mother, I wanted very much to understand it so I could help. And we've always discussed it. We've been very open. He's 14 now. He's very proud of the fact that he has autism. He's not embarrassed to share that information with anyone, and he knows that if he's in a difficult situation, he can inform somebody and he can help himself. But I remember when we first discussed his diagnosis, it took us until he was six to get a diagnosis, mainly because he has what used to be referred to as Asperger's. So I don't really like to use the term high functioning with autism, but That's what that would be. That's what that understanding would be. People with Asperger's tend to want to engage, but they don't always have the tools to do that. And that pretty much describes my son. He's very engaging, particularly with adults. He struggles a little more with kids his own age, but he doesn't often completely withdraw. He's, you know, and he can do supermarkets and cinemas, and, you know, he quite likes stimulating environments. But I love this book because what I and I know that opinions can be divided on it as well. I've read some reviews and like, oh, this has nothing to do with God. And, you know, but you see, if you know somebody with autism, you will understand why the book comes across in that way. It's written in a very unique and quirky way. For anyone who has somebody in their life with autism, they will immediately recognize the sort of the tone of the book. They can, you know, I read William Stillman's words and I can often very much hear how my son speaks and how he conducts himself. There's a very particular set of character traits, and obviously autism is a vast spectrum, and no two people with autism are the same, obviously, but there are characteristics that are similar. So I find that very endearing. And when I read, you know, I was reading through some reviews not so long ago of this book, and, you know, some people sort of picking up like, oh, there are grammatical errors and it doesn't really explain this. And I feel like I do when I feel about my son when he's in a situation with a group of people who don't know about his autism and they don't immediately read him correctly. I feel like I want to say, okay, just stop, pay attention. You know, what's really happening here? What can you learn from this person? Autism and the God connection, I feel, is really presenting is the idea that autism is not a burden that somebody is saddled with. And for all the challenges that can come from a family environment where there is one or more individuals with on the autistic spectrum, you do all have to adapt and find a different way to be. And it can be immensely challenging for everyone. But I always said to my son, right from the off, okay, this is just like learning a language. So, you know, you're really good at learning languages. I quite like learning languages. So, but unless you tell me, you know, you've got lots of words in your language that I don't understand, and you have to tell me what they are and explain what that means to you in your language so I can talk to you properly. And that's how we've always sort of held the idea. Surprise, surprise, my son is a really great linguist. He's really brilliant at copying languages and doing the accent, everything. So that makes sense to him. And I think this book is really important because it presents the idea that, you know, autism's often described as a hidden disability. And I would challenge that.
Problem.
It can But it's not a problem, it's not an issue, it's not a disability, it's actually a gift if you look closely enough. And, you know, like any gift, it can come with a dark side. There are disadvantages to any gift, in my opinion. And autism is no exception, but I regard it as an absolute privilege to be the mother of an individual with autism. It has widened my entire understanding of the world and whatever else there is outside of this world. I regard my son as somebody who is just vibrating on a higher frequency. And when you speak with people in the sort of spiritual, you know, people who practice spirituality, they very often use the word or the term frequency and vibration. And I think, well, here we have, you know, a group of individuals who are vibrating on a high frequency. They're very pure. You know, there's no misconceptions when you're dealing with somebody with autism. They tell it how it is, they see it how it is. And that can be offensive to some people. It can feel brutal and difficult, but I think that's where we get to the real gems of what we're really here to understand in life. And my son has taught me so much. And this book is a collection of, again, a collection of stories, of case histories, you know, anyone with somebody in their lives with autism will find this very familiar ground. And I would also urge anyone who doesn't have that connection with autism but wants to understand to read this book and to try to see past some of the quirky aspects or the bits that are sort of slightly jarring. That's what it's like being alongside a person with autism, but you have to just be patient and see past that and see what it is they really have to offer you, and it will blow you away. They are really exceptional individuals, and for my son in particular, he doesn't show a particular interest in the world of spirituality, but he has an incredible connection with animals. We have three cats in our house, and to him, they are people. You know, he has this incredible connection with them. He tells me what they think all the time. There's a brilliant book, actually, that's not on my list, but I think it's for children, but it's lovely. It's called All Cats Are on the Autistic Spectrum. and, you know, when you look at the behavior and the characteristics of cats, you can absolutely attribute some of them to autism. He's incredibly gifted musically. So, you know, he brings all of that to our lives. And I think there's so much more. There's so much more to him than I've, you know, to with all my children. But, you know, he brings a particular dimension. And I think this book is beautiful in that it shows how autism is a gift, and it's not a burden or a disability or something that you have to, you know, sort of battle with or get through. It's the people. I've often said to my husband, like, what if we're all wrong? What if we've got it wrong?
I think we are all autistic in some, you know, to some degree or another. It is a spectrum. Yes. And, you know, I have a very close association with autism, with a family member, and I totally agree with everything you're saying. It is a gift indeed.
It is.
So number seven, another baby book, Angel Babies and Other Amazing True Stories of Guardian Angels by Teresa Chung, published in 2009.
Yes. Now this book, Teresa Chung, I am privileged to say, I regard as a personal friend, although we have never met. So this book came to me, and I think I've jumped slightly out of chronology in the list that I gave to you originally. So this comes maybe a jump ahead of the other book. Teresa was quite active at the College of Psychic Studies during the time that I was studying there, but I actually didn't take any of her classes or encounter her there. I'd read several of her books. She's a prolific writer on, as I'm sure you're well aware, the spirit world. Currently her area is dreams. I believe she's now regularly on This Morning and various mainstream TV shows discussing precognition and premonitions and manifestation. But she's an amazing human being. She really is. She's written new in the 30s, possibly even the 40s now, books about the afterlife, and in her earlier work she tended to collate stories given by people about signs, symbols, angels, the afterlife, and so on. So I'd read several of her books, but this particular one, Angel Babies, came to me. It was a week after my daughter had died, and I was just kind of browsing my bookshelf at home. And one book, literally, my recollection is that this book fell out of the shelf and landed on my foot. Now, I don't know whether I touched it, whether I pulled it out. I don't know. I can't remember that closely. But I do remember. I remember thinking, good grief, that's literally jumped out of the shelf at me. What is it? Picked it up, Angel Babies. And to this day, I have no memory of buying this book. Now, that's not a particularly dramatic statement, because I buy a lot of books. So it's obviously I did buy it at some point. But it was really a bit shocking, because I just thought, what on earth? How did that get there? I really don't remember buying it. And again, it's a collation of stories about children who have passed a spirit, or children who have seen people in spirit, children with imaginary friends, and so on. And it addresses the idea that babies can be sent to us as sort of some kind of guardian angel, or with a purpose or a message. Coming at the time that it did, when I'd literally just lost my daughter, who was 5 months old when she died, I sat down and I read it. And I did something that I've never done before or since after I read it. Teresa always puts an email address or some kind of form of contact in the back of her books. And I thought, I'm going to email her. And I remember that I started my email, "I know you must get thousands of emails. Please do not feel you need to reply to this. I just need to tell you that I've, you know, come across this book of yours in a really peculiar way. I'm already a fan of your work. And I just want you to know that I'm in a really difficult situation in my life, and your book has really helped me. And I want to thank you." And she did reply to it. And I think at that point, shortly after my daughter died, I started writing a blog about my grief, which was ostensibly for sort of friends and family members to try and give them an idea of where I was at, really. And then because I loved to write, it ran away with me. And I just started writing this regular blog. And I think I had a link to the blog on the bottom of my email, because Teresa replied to my email and thanked me and offered me her condolences. And also said, "By the way, I just read some of your blog and I think you're a really great writer. And if you ever feel the need to write about your experience, please contact me and I will help you in any way I can." And at the time I just thought, well, that's really generous. But let's face it, we're British and that's a really British thing to do. To say like, "Oh, come round for dinner," when you don't really mean it. Or "let's stay in touch," or, you know, "ask me for help and I'll help you." And quite often, you're met with a bit of a brick wall and a sort of like, "Oh, they didn't really mean that." But I obviously did go on to, you know, writing my blog inspired me to think about writing a book about and for Romy, about this, the experiences that I had after she passed and why I think she was here in the first place. So I kind of dashed off an email to Teresa. It must have been a good year later, and just said, "Look, you know, again, don't think you remember me, but, you know, this is what you said. And look, just on the, any advice would be really welcome." And she again wrote back and said, "Look, you know, send me some chapters." She read the chapters. She recommended me to my publisher. She said, "Look, I'll endorse you. Tell them I'll endorse you. Write to this person, send them this." She was unbelievable. She was generous in a way that not many people are, particularly in that world. I got offered my publishing contract by the first publisher I approached. She did in fact write me a beautiful endorsement for my book. And to this day, we have an email correspondence, and I regard her as a friend. And I'm just so blessed that she came into my life, not only to help me to get my book out there, because I think it was meant to be, but she's just an extraordinarily generous spirited person, which is rare.
She's somebody who really walks her talk, a very lovely lady. And she has been on the 10 best.
Yes, she has.
She's wonderful. Okay, so we are going to have to really speed up now, because we've got two more books to go, and right. I do want to have at least a short talk with you about your own book, so we'll skate through the next two.
Okay.
The ninth book is The Artist's Way, A Spiritual Path to Higher Creativity, Julia Cameron, 1992. My only surprise here is that this book has not appeared more often.
Yes. So I discovered this during my first sort of foray into a writing group back in 2016, when our youngest son was about one. Ironically or not, I now actually work with this organisation. It's a local organisation in Brighton called Mothers Uncovered, who run creative. They're a charity and they run creative groups for women with young babies. So the focus being, you turn up with your baby, but it's actually all about you and not about your baby. So you do art, you make art, or you write, or whatever. So this was my experience at my Mothers Uncovered group, and we looked at The Artist's Way by Julian Cameron, which, as you will know, is a sort of a practical guide for creative writing. But I think it can benefit anyone, because the crux of it is, Julia Cameron says that, you know, basically, whether we want to write or not, it's really healthy when we get up, we can write four pages of A4 longhand. It can be the same word over and over. It can be a shopping list. It can be anything. It can just be last night's dream. You basically just vomit out what's in your head so you can get to what really matters. Now, as a writer, and I have gone on to begin to write fiction, it's a fantastic exercise. But I just still think it's kind of like meditation for people who can't meditate, and that would be me. My husband's really into it and has a meditation practice. I really try, but I struggle. And for me, that is akin to meditation. It just kind of clears your mind of the clutter and gets you to focus properly on your day. And as a little end to that story, a few months later, I decided to attend a Hay House writer's workshop and had no idea but who was the keynote speaker but Julia herself. And it was just a privilege to be in that room. She is such a quirky and entertaining speaker. She's hilarious. She's really irreverent, and she's just clever and sharp and witty, and she's just really good at what she does. So it was strange. That all came in the same kind of condensed into a few months. I'd never heard of it. There it was, and there she was. So it seemed somehow sort of synchronistic.
So book number 10, the final book, The Gift by Lewis Hyde, published in 1979. And Margaret Atwood, how's this as a masterpiece? Tell us why.
Nothing else is really necessary. If Margaret Atwood rates it, it's got to be good, right? But no, she says it's a masterpiece because it carries the message that creativity in this world of sort of money-driven, achievement-driven, dare I say it, sort of masculinity, it carries a message that creativity really matters. And not only that, but we can follow our purpose. It's, how do I put it? I can identify with, in that I feel that those of us who are drawn towards creative pursuits often grow up feeling or being told that, you know, that's really nice as a hobby, but you can't make money doing it. So, you know, get a proper job and do that as well. And that's what I often felt about writing. Not particularly driven by my parents, actually. They were always pretty supportive of the fact that I wanted to do it, but I think they would have been quite surprised if I'd said, so I'm going to just focus on writing as a job. So I think it gives us a sense of creativity being a path to finding our true purpose. There's a quote that I know I'm not going to drag out of my brain now, but it's something about, is it somebody like the Dalai Lama, about we basically spend our entire lives, it's about working to live versus living to work and vice versa, right? We spend our entire lives working, earning the money so that we can sort of stop working, and then we end up spending all that money on our declining health, which is declining because we were so stressed in our jobs. You know, and it kind of offers similar ideas like, well, you know, if we just kind of sought to make a living doing things that feel meaningful and joyful to us, maybe we'd have a happier life. It's very simple and seems very obvious, and it's quite tricky to encapsulate, but I think it's a masterpiece because it's like a manifesto for creativity.
Good. Okay, well, that's your 10 best list. Let's talk about you. You wrote your book, The Truth Inside. Just tell us a little bit about the book and what the book contains.
So the book is a memoir. I do talk a little bit, probably inspired by Sonia Choquette, about my own upbringing and my background and my sort of openness to spirituality. And then really I go into how that I moved away from that when Romy died. And that surprised me, actually. I kind of thought, I mean, I guess you could describe it as a type of faith. And I thought I would probably cling to it in a very difficult time. And in fact, I was pretty furious at it. One of the things on my mind being, well, I've spent all these years developing a psychic ability. How did I not know this was going to happen to me? Which is a very valid question to ask. And I've often thought many people reading my book may well be asking the same thing. So, and I started to, once I'd sort of calmed down about the whole thing, I realized that there was a lesson in there. And my husband and I started to talk about and ask ourselves, you know, what what was this lesson that Romy was meant to teach us? What is there a possibility that on a soul level, we all agreed that this would happen in order for all of us to advance spiritually in some way? And I started to sort of look to other people to answer those questions. But it was a very rocky road. I mean, I shut down on all of it. I didn't want to know. I went to a spiritualist church that I'd been a quite regular participant in not long after Romy died. And I just remember feeling completely disconnected from the whole experience. I came home, there was a medium on the platform giving messages from spirit. I kind of didn't want her to come to me, even though, you know, I was obviously desperate for answers to maybe hear from my daughter's spirit or somebody or something who could tell me something, anything about why this had happened, why I was in so much pain. And this medium didn't have a message for me. And I went home feeling disappointed and angry and disconnected from everything. And I remember I said to my husband, I am never setting foot in one of those places again. I was obviously going through one of the five stages of grief. I hilariously tried to explain to, I think, my sister that I can identify with all the others, but anger seems to have come, and I'm not angry at all. And I just remember everyone around me sort of, really? I was really furious. About the whole experience. But I remember just, I think it was a couple of weeks after that, just blurting out one evening, I think I'm going to go to the spiritualist church. And my husband said to me, just to clarify, the place you just said you were never going ever again. And I said, yes. And I don't know why I'm saying that I feel I need to go there, but I have to go. I'm just going. I'm going to go. So he supported me in doing that. And I remember on the drive there, I said, I used to talk to Romy often in the car when we were driving around together when she was a baby. And after her death, I sort of used to talk to her a lot in the car. That was the place that I kind of had lots of one-sided conversations with her. And I remember driving to the spiritualist church and saying to her out loud in my car, I know I said I wasn't going back to this place again, but, you know, in my heart, I know you're okay. I know you're okay. But also on a human level, I'm your mum and I need to hear you tell me that you're okay. I can't rest until I get some kind of sign or message that you're okay. That's all I need. That's all I need. So I got there, parked my car, went in, it was packed. There was a medium on the platform. I wish I could remember her name because she was brilliant. I remember her talking about how she worked and saying, you know, my method is like I come to people very quickly and I might just bombard you with information. And if anything's unclear, just ask me at the end. And as she was talking, I remember thinking, I know she's going to speak to me. And I remember thinking specifically, I'm going to be the third person she comes to. And I was standing right at the back of this really crowded hall. I have a locket with a photograph of Romy and a lock of her hair in, and I was like, putting that down. I had a scarf on. I was like, right, I'm not giving her any clues. I was the third person she came to, and she told me about the locket I was wearing. She told me about the lock of hair in it. She gave me some pretty impressive information. And even though I would say I don't know if believe is the right word, but that is within my light belief system. I do always look to disprove myself. Just, you know, I think that's healthy. Just like, you know what, really? Am I just really wanting that to be that thing? Or can I really, I don't use the word evidence because I think that requires proof and we can't provide any proof in those situations. But I look to solidify what I'm being told. But then she came out with something really spectacular, which is probably the most spectacular thing I've ever been told in any sitting. She said to me, okay, look, I'm getting, she had correctly identified that I'd lost a child, that it was a daughter, that she was very young. And she said, okay, I've got to move on to the next person, but I'm being told I've got to tell you something and it's very, very specific. And I have to give you these specific words. So I was thinking, oh my God, this is going to be something really, what, you know, like the meaning of life, like what's she going to tell me? And she said, I'm being told I have to tell you these words. I have to just say, I'm okay. And I, you know, it's such a simple thing to hear. But given that I'd just been talking out loud to my daughter in my car and I didn't have a phone on, there was the windows weren't down, there was nobody else, I was in motion. I cannot think of a single explanation for that. And that was specific. And for me, that was a real turning point, and that brought me back around to, and I started then to sort of look, seek out mediums, and I returned to the spiritualist church, and I started to write about what was happening around me, and things happened in our home, things would move, and then I would go and have a sitting with a medium who would say, like, has your TV been moving? And it had. And so these things started to be corroborated by the people that I sought out, and I had dreams that felt like more than dreams. So I just basically wrote everything down, and that really, that became, I have it here actually, that became my book. Even the cover of the book, I had a very clear dream where I clearly saw this image of an open door with a field, and the publisher sort of said, well, we never allow authors to pick their own cover, but actually we're going to go with this one because it, you know, all of these things made me think this book was meant to be here. And I guess the final point was in my dream, I remember saying to my husband, it's really weird. You know, Gordon Smith wrote the endorsement for my book. I'm sure many of your listeners will know Gordon Smith is a fabulous medium, and I'd admired him for many years, and I'd seen him doing platform work years ago before I had children. And in that congregation, he had in fact come to a couple who'd recently lost their son. And I'd remembered this. And I remember saying to myself, that's really bit. I just dreamt that Gordon Smith endorsed my book. And then I thought, well, actually, how possible would that be? And I looked him up and I saw that he was doing a workshop in the next town along from where I live. And I thought, I'm going to book myself on that workshop. That would be a great thing to do anyway. And I might just take a few copies, you know, just a copy of a few chapters with me, you know, just on the off chance. And so I did. I went to him and I explained and I said, look, I feel really embarrassed asking you, but I've written this book. I know how busy you are. If you happen to have like 10 minutes, just if you could possibly write me a line, anything, I'd be so grateful. And I kind of came away from it thinking, okay, you know, I did it. Nothing will come of it, I'm sure. But, you know, he emailed me a week later and said, you know, I'd be delighted. What, you know, an amazing book. What do you want me? And he, you know, and my dream came, you know, he's there. He's on the front of my book. He wrote me a beautiful endorsement. So everything about this book for me feels that it was meant to be. And it is the book that I wish that I'd had when I just lost my daughter, because I'd read and read and read about spiritual ideas. And I felt that I was fairly knowledgeable on that front, but I was also in a great deal of pain. And it's at that point I found it was quite difficult. You could find lots of support if you'd lost your child, but there wasn't much. You know, I think of the Forever Family Foundation in the US. They're not here in the UK, but, you know, I needed something like that in the UK, some organization or book or place that I could go to where I could speak with other mothers and parents whose children had died, and we could get beyond, oh, how terrible we feel and how tragic it all is, and onto why has this happened? Where are they? Where is their spirit? What do we have to learn from this? I didn't feel I had a forum where I could discuss those things. And so I've tried to address those things in my book. And if it helps one other person who's looking for those sorts of that sort of information, then that's a job well done, in my opinion.
Good. Ali, I'm really sorry. We are out of time. I'm going to have to end it here. I want to thank you very much for adding your 10 best list of spiritual books to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's Library of Recommendations. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, Sandy.
You're welcome. Okay, that's it for this week. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. I'll be back at the same time next week with another 10 best interview for the No BS Spiritual Book Club. If you would like to see more of these interviews, go to the website nobsspiritualbookclub.com and register for our Save My Space list, and we'll keep you up to date on future episodes. That's it. Till next week, it's goodbye from me. And thank you, Ali Noel.